Chapter 3 of the book by Rudolf Steiner entitled An Outline of Esoteric Science, entitled Sleep and Death. Just as we cannot solve the riddle of life without considering death, we also cannot break through to understanding the essence of waking consciousness without considering the state we pass through during sleep. Someone who has no feeling for the significance of supersensible knowledge may entertain doubts about this knowledge simply because of its views on sleep and death. We can appreciate the reason for these doubts. There is nothing incomprehensible about it if someone states that human beings are here in order to lead an active and effective life, that purposeful activity depends on being able to devote ourselves to this life, and that delving into conditions like sleep and death can result only from a penchant for idle dreaminess and lead only to empty fantasies. It is easy for people to believe that rejecting such fantasies is a sign of a healthy soul, and that devoting oneself to idle dreaminess is a pathological trait that is present only in people who lack both joy and in life and the strength to tackle it, and who are incapable of real purposeful activity. It would be doing this opinion an injustice to present it as totally false, because there is a certain kernel of truth in it. It is a quarter truth that needs the other three quarters for completeness. If we attack the one quarter of it that is true, we will simply arouse the suspicions of those who see that quarter very nearly, very clearly, but have no inkling of the other three. It must be acknowledged without reservation that investigating what is hidden behind the veils of sleep and death actually is pathological if it leads to weakness and estrangement from real life. Likewise, we must agree that much of what called itself esoteric science in the past, as well as much of what is practiced today under that name, bears the imprint of something unhealthy and hostile to life. But this unhealthy element does not spring from true supersensible knowledge. On the contrary, the real fact of the matter is this: just as we cannot always be awake when it comes to the real circumstances of life in the broadest sense, we also cannot get along without what the supersensible element can offer us. Life continues while we are asleep, and our forces for the working and creating we do while we are awake gain strength and refreshment from what sleep gives them. This is how things stand with what we can observe in the manifest world. But the world is broader in scope than that particular field of observation, and what we know in the visible world must be complemented and fructified by what can be known about the invisible worlds. If we did not repeatedly draw strength for our depleted forces from sleep, we would destroy our life. Similarly, a worldview not fructified by a knowledge of the hidden element inevitably leads to desolation. Something similar is true of death. Living things succumb to death so that new life can come about. Knowledge of the supersensible element is precisely what can shed light on Goethe's beautiful words, quote, "Life is nature's most beautiful invention, and death is a trick it plays in order to have abundant life." Footnote, an aphorism on nature in Goethe's Naturwissenschaftlichen Schriften, Works on Natural Science, edited with commentary by Rudolf Steiner in Kirchner's Deutsche Nationalliteratur, National Literature of Germany, 5 volumes, 1884 to 1897. End footnote. Just as there would be no life in the usual sense of the word if there were no death, there can be no real knowledge of the visible world without insight into the supersensible realm. All knowledge of the visible must immerse itself in the invisible again and again in order to be able to evolve. Thus it is evident that the science of the supersensible is what makes the existence of revealed knowledge altogether possible. When it appears in its true form, this science of the invisible never weakens life. It repeatedly strengthens it and makes it fresh and healthy when it has become weak and sick from having been left on its own. When we fall asleep, the connection between the elements of our makeup changes. The part of a human being that lies sleeping on the bed contains the physical body and ether body, but not the astral body or ego. Life's processes continue during sleep because the ether body remains united with the physical body. If the physical body were left to itself, it would have to disintegrate, What is extinguished in sleep, however, are our mental images, our pain and pleasure, joy and sorrow, our ability to express our conscious intentions and similar realities of our existence. The astral body is the vehicle of all these, however. If we are unbiased in our assessment of this situation, we will never be able to entertain the notion that the astral body is destroyed during sleep, along with all our pleasure and pain and the entire world of our ideas and will. It is simply present in a different state. For our I and astral body to have a conscious perception of our pain and suffering and all the other things just listed, rather than simply being filled with them, the astral body must be connected to the physical body and the ether body. And in fact it is connected when we are awake, but not when we are asleep. In sleep, the astral body withdraws. It takes on a different form of existence than the one it has when it is connected to the physical and ether bodies. So the next task for supersensible knowledge is to consider the astral body's other form of existence. As far as observation in the external world is concerned, the astral body disappears during sleep. Now, supersensible perception's job is to follow it until it takes possession of the physical and ether bodies once again when we wake up. As in all cases involving knowledge of the world's hidden things and processes, discovering the particulars of what is really going on in the state of sleep requires supersensible observation. Once what can be discovered by this means has been stated, however, it is immediately understandable to truly unbiased thinking, because processes in the hidden world have effects that are visible in the manifest world. Once we see how the contribution of supersensible observation makes sense-perceptible processes understandable, such corroboration by life itself constitutes the proof that can be required for such things. Those who choose not to use the methods of attaining supersensible perception that will be explained later will still be able to have the experience of accepting the statements of supersensible knowledge and applying them to manifest things in their own experience. By doing so, they will find that life becomes clear and understandable. The more precisely and thoroughly they consider ordinary life, the more they will come to this conviction. Even though the astral body experiences no mental images during sleep, no pleasure or pain or anything similar, it does not remain inactive. On the contrary, it is obliged to maintain a lively activity in the sleeping state, an activity it must take up again and again in rhythmical succession after periods of being involved in the activity that it shares with the physical and ether bodies. Just as the pendulum of a clock that has swung to the left and then comes back to the middle must then swing to the right because of the momentum gained by swinging to the left, the astral body and the I that rests in its bosom, having been active for a while in the physical and ether bodies, must then spend the next period of time being busy and active in the body-free state, in an environment of soul and spirit. As far as our normal state of life is concerned, unconsciousness sets in when the astral body and the I are in this body-free state, because this represents the counterbalance to the state of consciousness that develops in the waking state through union with the physical and ether bodies, just as the pendulum's swing to the right is the counterbalance to its swing to the left. The soul's spiritual principle in the human being experiences needing to enter this state of unconsciousness as fatigue. However, this fatigue is the expression of the fact that during sleep, the astral body and I are preparing themselves to reform during the next period of wakefulness what has arisen in the physical and ether bodies through purely organic and unconscious formative activity while they were free of the spirit and soul principles. This unconscious formative activity is the polar opposite of what happens in the human being during consciousness and by means of consciousness. These states must alternate in rhythmical succession. The usual view on the connection between sleep and fatigue are not in line with the facts. We think that sleep sets in as a consequence of fatigue. This is an oversimplified idea, as is shown by the fact that people often fall asleep during uninteresting lectures or on other similar occasions, even if they aren't tired at all. Anyone who insists that such occasions make us tired is trying to explain this phenomenon by applying a method that lacks cognitive integrity. Unbiased observation will certainly show us that waking and sleeping represent different relationships of the soul to the body. Like a pendulum swinging alternately to the right and to the left, these relationships alternate in rhythmic succession in the ordinary course of life. This same unbiased observation reveals that the state of being filled with impressions of the outer world awakens within the soul a desire to follow this state with a different one, in which the soul is absorbed in enjoying its own bodily nature. Two states of soul alternate, surrendering to outer impressions and surrendering to one's own bodily nature. During the first state, the desire for the second is produced unconsciously. The second state then runs its course in unconsciousness. Fatigue is the expression of wanting to enjoy our own bodily nature. So, instead of saying that we want to sleep because we feel tired, we actually ought to say that we feel tired because we want to sleep. Since the human soul can, as a sort of adaptation, evoke at will states that normally appear as a matter of necessity, it is also possible for us to evoke the desire to enjoy our own bodily nature when we have numbed ourselves to a given outer impression. That is, we fall asleep, even though our inner condition gives us no reason to do so. The physical body can only be maintained in a shape and form suitable for a human being by means of a human ether body, which must in turn receive the appropriate forces from an astral body. The ether body is the sculptor or architect of the physical body. However, it can only shape the body in the right way if it receives the stimulus to do so from the astral body. The astral body contains the prototypes, according to which the ether body gives the physical body its form. During the waking state, the astral body is not filled with these prototypes of the physical body, or only to a certain extent, because the soul puts images of its own in their place. When we direct our senses to our surroundings, we form mental images by means of perception, mental images that are likenesses of the world around us. Initially, these likenesses disturb the images that stimulate the ether body to maintain the physical body. If our own activity were to supply our astral body with images that would stimulate the ether body in the right way, this disturbance would not happen. In fact, however, this disturbance, which is expressed in the fact that the prototypes for the ether body are not fully effective during the waking state, plays an important role in human existence. In the waking state, the astral body carries out its activity within the physical body, while in sleep it works upon it from outside. Just as the physical body, which is of the same nature as the outer world, needs the outer world to supply it with nourishment, for example, something similar is also true of the astral body. Imagine a physical human body removed from the world that surrounds it. It would have to perish. This demonstrates that without its whole physical environment, it could not exist. In fact, the entire earth must be just the way it is if physical human bodies are to exist on it. In reality, the entire human body is simply a part of the earth, or, in a wider sense, part of the whole physical universe. In this connection, its relationship is similar to that of a finger on one hand to the entire human body. If we sever the finger from the hand, it can no longer remain a finger. It withers away. The same thing would happen to a human body if it were removed from the body it is part of, from the living conditions provided by the earth. If we were to raise it a sufficient number of miles above the earth's surface, it would die, just as a finger severed from the hand dies. If we pay less attention to this fact with regard to our own physical bodies than with regard to fingers, this is simply because fingers cannot stroll around freely on the body the way people can on the earth, so the dependence of fingers is more obvious. Just as the physical body is embedded in the physical world to which it belongs, the astral body is also embedded in a world of its own. However, it is torn out of this world during our waking life. An analogy will illustrate what happens in this case. Imagine a container full of water. A single drop in this volume of water is not something separate and independent. But then, suppose we take a little sponge and absorb one drop out of the whole amount. Something similar happens with the human astral body when we wake up. During sleep, it is in a world that is like itself. In a certain sense, it constitutes something belonging to that world. But when we wake up, the physical body and the ether body absorb it and fill themselves with it. They contain the organs through which it perceives the outer world. But in order to acquire this perception, it must separate itself from the other world to which it belongs. However, it can only receive the prototypes it needs for the ether world from this other world. In the sleeping state, the astral body receives images from the world that surrounds it, just as the physical body receives nourishment from its surroundings, for example. The astral body actually lives out there, in the universe, outside the physical and ether bodies, in the same universe that gave birth to the entire human being. This universe is the source of the images we use to maintain our form, and we are harmoniously incorporated into it during sleep. As we awaken, we lift ourselves up out of this all-encompassing harmony in order to acquire outer perception. During sleep, our astral bodies return to the harmony of the universe again. When we awaken, we bring enough strength with us out of the cosmic harmony into our bodies so that we can go without being in that state for a while. The astral body returns home during sleep and brings renewed forces back into our life when we awaken. The outer expression of this is the refreshment that healthy sleep bestows on us. Further esoteric scientific descriptions will show that the astral body's home is more encompassing than the aspect of the physical environment that belongs to the physical body in the narrower sense. While we humans, as physical beings, are part of the earth, our astral bodies are part of a world that embraces additional heavenly bodies. During sleep, therefore, we enter a world that encompasses other worlds in addition to our earth. As mentioned before, this fact will only become clear from later descriptions. It ought to be superfluous to point to a misunderstanding that can easily arise with regard to these facts, but this is not the case in an age when certain materialistic ways of thinking are present. Of course, people who subscribe to these views can say that the only scientific thing to do is to investigate the physical conditions of something such as sleep. They can say that even though experts are not yet united on the subject of the physical cause of sleep, one thing is certain: we must assume that specific physical processes are the basis of this phenomenon. If only people would admit that supersensible knowledge in no way contradicts this claim. It agrees with everything that is said from this point of view. Just as we all agree that in the physical construction of a house, one brick must be placed on top of another, and that when the house is finished, its structure and the fact that it holds together can be explained in terms of purely mechanical laws. In order for the house to come about, however, the architect's idea is needed, and this idea is nowhere to be found when we investigate only the physical laws that apply. Just as the thoughts of the person who created the house lie behind the physical laws that make it explainable, the statements of supersensible knowledge also lie behind what physical science quite correctly presents. It is true that this comparison, which may be considered trivial, is often used to justify the idea of a spiritual backdrop to the world, but in such matters the important thing is not that we are familiar with specific concepts, but that we attach the right value to them in arguing the point. The mere fact that opposing ideas exercise so much power over our capacity for judgment can prevent us from assessing this value correctly. Dreaming is an intermediate state between waking and sleeping. To thoughtful consideration, dream experiences consist of a colorful intermingling of images in a world that conceals an element of regularity and lawfulness within it, although at first glance this world seems to reveal an often confusing ebb and flow. In dreaming, we are released from the laws of waking consciousness that fetter us to sensory perception and to the rules that govern our power of judgment. And yet, dreams obey certain mysterious laws that are fascinating and alluring to our faculty of surmising, and are the deeper reason why we so readily compare dreaming to the beautiful play of imagination that supports artistic sensitivity. We will find this confirmed if we simply recall a few characteristic dreams. We dream, for example, about driving off a dog that is about to pounce on us. We wake up to catch ourselves in the unconscious act of throwing off the covers, where they were weighing on an unaccustomed body part and starting to bother us. What does dreaming do to a sense-perceptible process in this case? Our sleeping life allows what our senses would perceive in the waking state to remain fully unconscious for the moment. But it does hold fast to one essential thing, the fact that we are trying to get rid of something. It spins a pictorial process around this fact. The images, as such, are echoes of our daily waking life, but there is something arbitrary in the way they are borrowed from it. We have the feeling that although the same external provocation might also conjure up other pictures in our dream, these would still symbolically express the sensation of wanting to get rid of something. Dreams create symbols. They are symbolists. Inner processes can also be transformed into dream symbols. Suppose we dream that a fire is crackling nearby. We see the flames in our dream. We wake up and find that we have been too warmly covered and are getting hot. The feeling of too much warmth expresses itself in the dream image. Very dramatic experiences can be enacted in dreams. We dream, for instance, that we are standing at the edge of a cliff. We see a child running toward the edge. The dream lets us experience all our tormenting thoughts. If only the child would pay attention and not fall over the cliff. We see the child fall and hear a dull thud as the body lands. We wake up and find that something hanging on the bedroom wall has fallen down with a dull thump. In the dream, this simple process is expressed in exciting images. At the moment, we need not wonder about how it is possible for the momentary dull thud of a falling object to trigger a whole series of events that seemed to take place over a certain span of time. We only need to consider how the dream makes an image out of what sense perception would offer if we were awake. We see that as soon as our sensory activity comes to a halt, something creative asserts itself in us. This is the same creativity that is also present in completely dreamless sleep, where it appears as the soul state that is the opposite of the waking state. In order for this dreamless sleep to set in, the astral body must have withdrawn from the ether body and the physical body. During dreams, it is separated from the physical body in that it is no longer connected to our sense organs, but it still maintains a certain connection to the ether body. That we can perceive the astral body's processes in image form is due to this connection. When it ceases, the images immediately sink down into the darkness of the unconscious, and we have dreamless sleep. That dream pictures are arbitrary and often absurd is due to the fact that the astral body is not able to relate its images to the right objects and processes in our external surroundings, because it is separated from the physical body's sense organs. This state of affairs becomes much clearer when we consider a dream in which the I seems to split into two. For instance, when someone dreams of sitting in a classroom and being unable to answer a certain question, which the teacher then answers immediately. In this case, the dreamer cannot make use of the physical body's organs of perception, and is therefore not in a position to relate these two occurrences to one and the same person, namely his or herself. In order for each of us to recognize the enduring I in ourselves, we must first be equipped with organs of outer perception. This enduring I would only be perceptible to us outside the physical body if we had acquired the ability to become aware of it in some way other than through these organs of perception. It is up to supersensible consciousness to acquire the faculties needed for this. We will talk about the means of acquiring these faculties later on in this book. Death, too, occurs only because of a change in the relationship between the elements of our makeup. Here again, the effects of what supersensible perception describes can be seen in the manifest world, and if our power of judgment is unbiased, we will be able to confirm the communications of supersensible knowledge by observing outer life. However, in this case, the expression of the invisible in the visible is less apparent, and it is more difficult to fully recognize the significance of how the processes of outer life confirm what supersensible knowledge communicates. To those who refuse to understand how the sense perceptible contains a clear indication of the supersensible, claiming that these communications are mere figments of the imagination seems even more natural than saying the same of many things that have already been discussed in this book. During the transition to sleep, the astral body is simply released from its connection to the ether body and the physical body, which remain connected to each other. At death, however, the physical body also separates from the ether body. The physical body is given over to its own inherent forces. As a corpse, it must disintegrate. After death, the ether body, however, finds itself in a condition that it never experienced between birth and death, except under certain exceptional conditions that will be spoken of later. It is now united with the astral body, but without the presence of the physical body, because the ether and astral bodies do not separate from each other immediately after death. It is easy to understand the need for the force that holds them together for a time. If that force were not present, the ether body would not be able to extricate itself from the physical body at all. In sleep, for example, they are held together, and the astral body is incapable of tearing them apart. The requisite force takes effect at death, severing the ether body from the physical body, so that the ether body is now connected with the astral body. Supersensible observation shows that this connection is different in different people, but lasts for a matter of days. For the moment, this time period will be mentioned only as a point of information. Later, the astral body separates from its ether body and continues on its way without it. While these two bodies are still connected, we are in a state that allows us to perceive the experiences of our astral body. As long as the physical body is present, the work of restoring its worn-out organs must begin from outside as soon as the astral body is released from it, but once the physical body has been cast off, this work is no longer necessary. However, the force formerly used for this purpose during sleep persists after death and can now be used to make the astral body's own processes perceptible. If our processes of observation cling to life's externalities, we may still say that these are all claims that may be clear to those gifted with supersensible sight, but for everyone else there is no possibility of arriving at the truth of the matter. This is not the case. After supersensible knowledge discovers something in this or any other domain that is removed from ordinary perception, it can be grasped by our ordinary power of judgment. We must simply give the right consideration to relationships in life in the manifest world. The relationships among thinking, feeling, and willing, and their relationship to our experiences in the outer world, remain inherently incomprehensible as long as the character of their revealed activity is not seen as the expression of an unrevealed activity. This revealed activity becomes transparent to judgment only when the activity and the course it runs in the physical life of a human being can be seen as resulting from what supersensible knowledge concludes about non-physical things. If we confront this activity without benefit of supersensible knowledge, it is as if we were in a dark room with no light. Just as we see the physical objects in our surroundings only when light is present, what takes place in our soul life becomes explainable only in the presence of supersensible knowledge. As long as we are connected to the physical body, the outer world enters our consciousness in the form of images or reproductions. But after we cast that body off, we begin to perceive what our astral body experiences when it is not connected to the outer world by physical sense organs. At first, the astral body has no new experiences. Its connection to the ether body prevents it from experiencing anything new. However, it does possess a memory of the life that is just over. The still-present ether body allows this memory to appear as a comprehensive living picture. So, our first experience after death is a perception of life between death and birth as a series of images spread out in front of us. During that life, memory was present only during the waking state, during union with our physical bodies, and only to the extent that these physical bodies permitted. But nothing that makes an impression on the soul during life is ever lost to it. If the physical body were the perfect instrument for this, it would be possible at any moment in life to make our entire life appear to the soul. At death, the physical body's hindrance disappears. As long as the ether body persists, a certain perfect memory is present, but this disappears to the extent that the ether body loses the form, similar to the physical body, that it had while dwelling in that body. This is also the reason why the astral body separates from the ether body after a while. It can only remain united with an ether body whose form still corresponds to the physical body. During life, between birth and death, the ether body separates from the physical body only in exceptional instances and only for brief periods. For example, a portion of the ether body can separate from the physical because of excessive pressure on one of our limbs. In this case, we say that the limb in question has, quote-unquote, gone to sleep. That peculiar feeling comes from the separation of the ether body. Parenthesis, of course, this is another opportunity for a materialistic view of things to deny the presence of the invisible in the visible, saying that this all stems from the physical disturbance caused by the pressure. Parenthesis. In a case like this, supersensible observation can see how the corresponding part of the ether body slips out of the physical. If a person experiences extreme fright or some similar unusual shock, the ether body may separate from the greater part of the physical body for a very short time. This happens if, for whatever reason, we suddenly find ourselves near death, on the verge of drowning, for example, or in danger of falling while rock climbing. The accounts of people who have experienced such things actually come very close to the truth and can be confirmed by supersensible observation. They state that in such moments their entire lives passed in front of their souls like a great picture in their memories. Of the many examples that could be given here, only one will be referred to because it comes from a man whose personal philosophy would consider everything said about such things here to be sheer fantasy. For those who have made a few steps in the direction of supersensible observation, it's always very useful to become familiar with such accounts by people for whom supersensible science is mere fantasy, since it is not so easy to attribute these accounts to bias on the part of the observer. Parenthesis, it is to be hoped that spiritual scientists will learn a great deal from those who consider their efforts ridiculous, and it need not confuse them if their critics do not return their affection. Of course, supersensible observation itself does not aim to verify its own results through such things. It refers to them not in order to prove its findings, but only to clarify them. Parenthesis. In his memoirs, Moritz Benedict, an eminent criminologist and well-known researcher in many other fields of natural science, relates a personal experience. Once he nearly drowned while swimming and saw his whole life flash before him in retrospect as if in a single picture. Footnote. Moritz Benedict, 1835 to 1920, in his autobiography Aus meinem Leben, Erinnerungen und Erörterungen, Excerpts from My Life, Recollections and Commentary, Vienna, 1906, page 35, Benedict describes this instance as follows, quote, I have had a great love for water ever since childhood, and this has prompted several experiences that stick in my memory. I went to great lengths to be able to swim outdoors, and once it happened that I went under while swimming in the Danube. Fortunately, I was driven up against a post that served as a marker for swimmers. For scarcely more than half a minute, I was conscious of the fact that I was drowning, and made the remarkable observation that in that brief time my memories of my entire life passed in front of me at top speed. Psychologists are familiar with this observation, but few people have experienced it personally. I was about 12 years old at the time. End of footnote. If the images seen by others on similar occasions are described differently and even seem to have little to do with the events of their past, this does not contradict what was said above. The images that arise in this unusual state of separation from the physical body are often not readily explainable in terms of their relationship to life. However, if they are considered in the right way, this relationship can always be recognized. If someone was once near drowning and did not have the experiences described here, this in no way detracts from the general description. We must keep in mind that these experiences can take place only when the ether body is really separated from the physical body, but remains united with the astral body. When the shock also causes a loosening of the connection between the ether body and the astral body, these experiences do not take place because complete loss of consciousness occurs, as it does during dreamless sleep. In the time immediately after death, our experiences of the past appear, combined into a single memory picture. After that, the astral body separates from the ether body and continues its journey on its own. It is not difficult to see that everything the astral body acquired through its own activity during its stay in the physical body now remains in it. The I developed the spirit self, the life spirit, and the spirit body to a certain extent. To the extent that these have been developed, they do not owe their existence to the organs of the various bodies, but to the I, which needs no outer organs, either for self-perception or to remain in possession of what it has united with itself. In that case, we might wonder why we have no perception during sleep of the spirit self, life spirit, and spirit body that have developed. The reason for this is that the I is fettered to the physical body between birth and death. Even when it is with the astral body outside the physical body during sleep, it is still closely connected to the physical body because the astral body's activity is directed toward the physical body at that point. In this state, the I and its perception are directed toward to the outer sensory world and prevented from receiving the revelations of the spirit directly. Death allows these revelations to reach the I for the first time, because death frees the I from its connection to the physical and ether bodies. The moment the soul withdraws from the physical world that lays claim to all of its activity during life, another world lights up for it. Even during this time, not all of our connections to the outer sense-perceptible world have been terminated. Instead, they are maintained by certain desires that are still present. These desires are the ones we create through being conscious of the I as the fourth element of our makeup. Desires and wishes that spring from the nature of the three lower bodies can only be active in the external world, and they cease when these bodies are discarded. Hunger, for example, comes about through the external body and is silenced as soon as this body is no longer connected to the I. If the I had no desires other than those that originate in its own spiritual nature, it would be completely satisfied by the spiritual world into which it is transported at death. Life, however, has given it other desires. Life kindled a longing in it for pleasures that can only be satisfied by physical organs, although these pleasures are not inherent in the organs themselves. The three bodies are not the only elements that expect satisfaction from the physical world. The I also finds certain pleasures in this world, pleasures that the spiritual world has no means of providing. For the I, there are two types of desires in life: those that originate within the bodies and must also be satisfied there, coming to an end when the bodies disintegrate, and those that originate in its own spiritual nature. The latter are also satisfied by means of bodily organs as long as the I inhabits the bodies, since the hidden element of the spirit manifests in bodily organs. Along with everything the senses perceive, they also take in something spiritual. This spiritual element is also present after death, although in a different form. Everything of a spiritual nature that the eye desires within the sense-perceptible world is also still there when the senses are no longer present. If there were not a third type of desire in addition to these two, death would signify only a transition from desires that can be satisfied by the senses to those that find fulfillment in the revelation of the spiritual world. The third type of desire consists of the ones the I creates for itself during life in the sense-perceptible world, because it also takes pleasure in aspects of this world in which the spirit does not manifest. The lowest pleasures can be manifestations of the spirit. The satisfaction a hungry being gains from taking in food is a manifestation of the spirit, because if it did not take in nourishment, the spiritual element would not be able to evolve in a certain respect. However, the eye can also move beyond the enjoyment offered by this necessary state of affairs. It can long for food that tastes good, regardless of how eating serves the spirit. The same thing happens with regard to other things in the sensory world. This creates desires that would never appear in the sense-perceptible world if the human eye were not incorporated into it. Such desires, however, also do not originate in the spiritual nature of the eye. Even as a spiritual being, the eye must have sensory pleasures as long as it lives in a body. The spirit manifests in sense-perceptible things, and the eye is enjoying nothing other than the spirit when it gives itself up to sense-perceptible things through which the light of the spirit shines. The eye will continue to enjoy this light, even when sensuality is no longer the medium for the rays of the spirit. In the spiritual world, however, no gratification exists for desires not already inhabited by the spirit in the sense-perceptible world. When death occurs, the possibility of satisfying these particular desires is cut off. The desire to enjoy good-tasting food can only be satisfied when the physical organs used in taking in food are present, the palate, the tongue, and so on. After shedding the physical body, we no longer have these. And if the eye still needs to have these desires satisfied, this need must remain unmet. To the extent that this desire is in accord with the spirit, it is present only as long as the physical organs are there. But to the extent that the eye has created it without serving the spirit, it persists after death as a desire that yearns in vain for satisfaction. We can only get an idea of what then takes place in the human being by imagining that someone is suffering from raging thirst in an area where there is no water far or near. That is how things stand with the eye after death, to the extent that it still cherishes unextinguished desires for the pleasures of the outer world and no longer possesses organs that could satisfy them. Of course, we must imagine the raging thirst that is an analogy for the state of the eye after death as being intensified immeasurably and encompassing all other remaining desires that cannot possibly be satisfied. After death, the eye immediately finds itself in the situation of having to free itself from the shackles of this attraction to the outer world. In this respect, the eye has to bring about purification and liberation within itself. It must eradicate all the desires that came about in it during life in the body, which therefore have no right to exist in the spiritual world. The world of these desires is dissolved and destroyed after death like an object that is seized and consumed by fire. This offers us a glimpse into the world that supersensible knowledge calls the, quote, consuming fire of the spirit, unquote. Any desire that is sensual in nature, in a sense that is not an expression of the spirit, is seized upon by this fire. We might feel terrified and inconsolable when we confront the conceptions of these processes that spiritual science inevitably supplies. It might seem shocking that a hope that needs sense organs for its fulfillment must turn into hopelessness after death, and that a desire can only be satisfied by the physical world must be transformed into searing deprivation. However, it is possible to maintain this view only as long as we fail to consider that all the desires seized upon by this consuming fire after our death are not beneficial ones in any higher sense, but represent destructive forces in life. Through such forces, the eye binds itself more closely to the world of the senses than is necessary for taking in its beneficial aspects. This world is a revelation of the spiritual element concealed behind it. If the eye chose not to make use of the senses to enjoy this spiritual element, it would never be able to enjoy the spirit in this form, in which it can reveal itself only through the bodily senses. However, to the extent that the eye desires the aspects of the sense world, in which the spirit does not speak, it deprives itself of the world's true spiritual reality. if sensory enjoyment as an expression of the spirit signifies an elevation and development of the I, then enjoyment that is not such an expression signifies impoverishment and desolation. If a desire of this latter sort is satisfied in the sense world, its devastating effect on the eye, although present, does not become visible until after death. That is why enjoying such pleasures in life can create new, similar desires, although we are not at all aware that we are enveloping ourselves in a consuming fire. What becomes visible after death is nothing other than what was already present around us during life. And when it becomes visible, its healing, beneficial consequences also become evident. For example, a person who loves someone else is not attracted only to the aspects of the other person that can be experienced through physical organs. However, these are the only aspects that can be said to become inaccessible to perception at death. After death, the aspect of the beloved person, for which physical organs were only a means to an end, becomes visible. In fact, the only thing that prevents this other, higher aspect from being completely visible is the presence of desires that can only be satisfied by means of physical organs. If this desire were not eradicated, conscious perception of the beloved person after death could not come about at all. Seen in this way, the terrifying, inconsolable conception we might have of post-death events, as they are described by supersensible knowledge, is transformed into a conception that is deeply satisfying and consoling. The experiences we have immediately after death differ from life's experiences in still another respect. During purification, we live life in reverse, so to speak. We go through everything we experienced during life since birth, but in reverse order, back to childhood, beginning with events immediately preceding our death. In this process, everything in our life that did not originate in the spiritual nature of the I appears spiritually before us, but we experience its inverse. For example, if a person dies at age 60 but injured someone else in body or soul at age 40, he or she will experience this event again on reaching this point in his or her 40th year on the journey back through life. However, what is experienced this time will not be the satisfaction that came from attacking the other, but the pain the other person suffered as a result. From what has just been described, we can immediately see that the only part of such an incident that can be perceived as painful after death is the part originating in a desire of the I that has its source purely in the outer physical world. In reality, the I not only harms the other person by satisfying such a desire, it also harms itself. But this damage remains invisible during life. After death, however, this whole damaging world of desire becomes visible to the I. The I then feels drawn to every being and thing that once kindled such desires in it, so that these desires can be eradicated in the consuming fire, in the same way that they were created. On our journey back through life, all our desires of this sort will have gone through the fire of purification only when we reach the point of our birth again. From that point onward, nothing prevents us from dedicating ourselves completely to the spiritual world. We enter a new level of existence. Just as we discarded the physical body at death, and the ether body soon after, the part of the astral body that can survive only in our consciousness of the outer world now disintegrates. For supersensible knowledge, therefore, there are three corpses, the physical, the etheric, and the astral. We discard the last of these at the end of the purification period, which is about one-third as long as the time that elapses between birth and death. The reason for this will become clear later on when we consider the course of a human life on the basis of esoteric science. Just as physical corpses are physically perceptible in the world we live in, for supersensible observation, astral corpses are constantly present in the surroundings, having been discarded by human beings who are moving from the state of purification into a higher level of existence. As far as the eye is concerned, a totally new state of consciousness sets in after purification. Before death, outer perceptions had to flow toward the eye for the light of consciousness to shine on them. But now a world virtually flows outward from within and comes to consciousness. The eye lived in this world between birth and death too, but then it was veiled in sense-perceptible manifestations, only appearing in its real form when the eye disregarded all sense-perceptions and perceived itself in its own inner sanctuary. Just as pre-death self-perception on the part of the eye took place within, in its inner being, the world of spirit in all its fullness is also revealed from within after death and purification. Actually, this world is already revealed as soon as the ether body is discarded. It is simply obscured, as if by a darkening cloud, by all our desires that still turn toward the outer world. It is as if the dark, demonic shadows, rising from desires, consumed by fire, were mingling with a blissful world of spiritual experience. And not only shadows, these desires are real beings. This immediately becomes apparent when the eye is stripped of physical organs, and therefore becomes able to perceive things that are spiritual in character. These beings appear as distorted caricatures of what we formerly learned about through sense perception. Supersensible observation states that the world of the purifying fire is inhabited by beings whose appearance can be horrible and painful to the spiritual eye. EYE. They seem to take pleasure in destruction. Their passion is intent upon an evil that makes the evil of the sense-perceptible world seem insignificant in comparison. When we bring desires of the sort described above into the supersensible world, they appear to these creatures as food that constantly nourishes and strengthens their powers. This image of a world imperceptible to the senses can seem less incredible if we observe a portion of the animal kingdom without bias. To spiritual sight, what is a cruel, prowling wolf? What reveals itself in what the senses perceive in it? Nothing but a soul that lives in and acts out of desires. We can call the outward form of a wolf an embodiment of these desires. If we had no organs to perceive this form, we would still have to acknowledge the existence of the being in question if its invisible desires became visible through their effects. That is, if a power invisible to the eye were prowling around doing everything that can be done by a visible wolf. Now, it is true that the beings of the purifying fire are present only to supersensible consciousness and not to sense perception. However, their effects, namely the destruction of the eye if it supplies them with nourishment, are clearly evident. These effects become visible when justifiable enjoyment escalates to the point of immoderation and excess, for sense-perceptible things would also only attract the eye to the extent that enjoying them is somehow justified in the very nature of the eye itself. Animals are driven to desire only through things in the outer world that their three bodies crave. But human beings have higher desires, because a fourth element, the eye, is added to their three bodily elements. But if the eye seeks to satisfy such desires in a way that destroys its own being, rather than maintaining and furthering it, this is a result not of the effect of its three bodies, or of its own nature, but of beings whose true form is concealed from our senses, beings who can assail the higher nature of the eye, and are capable of arousing desires in it that, although unrelated to sensory existence, can only be satisfied through it. The food of these beings consists of passions and desires that are worse than any animal passions, because they are not played out in the sense world, but take hold of the spiritual element and drag it down into the domain of the senses. Therefore the forms of such beings appear much more hideous and gruesome to spiritual sight than the forms of the wildest animals, which only embody passions that are justifiable in the sense-perceptible world. The destructive forces of these beings are infinitely greater than any destructive fury that exists in the sense-perceptible animal kingdom. In this way, supersensible knowledge must expand our view to include a world of beings that are lower in a certain respect than any visible destructive animals. Having passed through this world after death, we then find ourselves face to face with a world that contains the spiritual element. The only desire this world arouses in us finds satisfaction in the spirit alone. Here, too, however, we distinguish between what belongs to our own eye and what constitutes its surroundings, what we might also call the spiritual world outside of the eye. Now, however, what we experience of these surroundings streams toward us in the same way that our perception of our own eye streams toward us during life in the body. During life, between birth and death, our surroundings speak to us through the organs of our bodies. But once we have discarded all our bodies, the language of our own surroundings speaks directly to the innermost sanctuary of the eye. Our entire surroundings are now filled with beings that are similar in nature to our eye, for only an eye has access to another eye. Just as we are surrounded in the sense-perceptible world by the minerals, plants, and animals that make up that world, after death we are surrounded by a world that is made up of beings of a spiritual nature. However, something that is not part of our surroundings there comes with us into the spiritual world, that is, what the eye has experienced in the sense-perceptible world. Immediately after our death, and for as long as our ether body is still connected to the eye, the sum total of these experiences appears temporarily in the form of a comprehensive memory picture. The ether body itself is then discarded, of course, but something of this memory picture remains behind as an imperishable possession of the eye, as if we had made an extract or distillation of everything that happened to us between birth and death. This is life's spiritual yield, its fruits. Since this yield is of a spiritual nature, it contains everything spiritual that has been revealed through our senses. Without life in the sense-perceptible world, it would not have come about. After death, the eye feels this spiritual fruit of the sensory world to be its own inner world, through which it enters the world of beings that manifest as only an eye can become manifest to itself in its innermost depths. Just as a plant seed, which is the essence of the entire plant, can only develop when it is planted in a different world, namely the soil, what the eye brings along from the sensory world now unfurls like a sprouting seed, and the spiritual environment that has received it begins to affect it. It is true that the science of the supersensible can only use images to describe what happens in this land of spirits. But when supersensible consciousness investigates the events invisible to the physical EYE that correspond to these images, it becomes evident that the images represent a true reality. Comparisons with the sensory world can illustrate what needs to be depicted, since although this other world is completely spiritual in character, it is similar to the sense world in a certain respect. For example, in the sensory world, a color appears when some object acts upon the eye, EYE. Similarly, in the land of spirits, an experience similar to the one induced by a color is produced when the eye is acted upon by another being. During life, between birth and death, however, the inner perception of the eye is the only experience that is induced in the same way as this color-like spiritual experience. This is not like light striking us from outside. It is as if another being were acting directly upon the eye, causing it to imagine this activity as a colored picture. Thus all the beings in the spiritual environment of the eye express themselves in a world radiant with color. Since the way they come about is different, of course, these experiences of color in the spiritual world are also of a somewhat different character than sense-perceptible colors, and something similar must be said with regard to the other impressions we receive from the sense-perceptible world. The sounds of the spiritual world are most similar to impressions in the sensory world. The more we live our way into the spiritual world, the more it appears to us as a freely moving vitality that is comparable to tones and harmonies in sense-perceptible reality. However, we do not sense these tones as something that approaches a sense organ from outside, but rather as a force streaming through the eye out into the world. We feel the tones the same way we feel our own speech or singing in the sense-perceptible world. But in the spiritual world, we know that these tones that are streaming out of us are also manifestations of other beings who are pouring themselves out into the world through us. A still higher manifestation takes place in the land of spirits when sound becomes the quote-unquote spiritual word. Then, not only the movement-filled vitality of another spiritual being, but also the being itself communicates its own inner nature to the eye. When this happens, when the spiritual word flows through the eye, two beings live within each other without any of the separation that is a necessary part of togetherness in the sense-perceptible world. This is really what it is like for the eye to be together with other spiritual beings after death. I'm on page 91. I have just finished paragraph 16 and is pretty much the first half of Sleep and Death from An Outline of Esoteric Science by Rudolf Steiner.